I alluded to some of the challenges we faced around, you know, people's addiction to Slack and the friction that we were actually adding whilst creating value. And I think that that was a big challenge that we definitely hadn't kind of fully grasped before we started the process. And that can be, you know, also just little things like within the Spoke desktop app, you know, you have Slack working in there, and within there, like huddles weren't working properly, for example. So just like little pieces of friction like this, where you're like, holy shit, like how did we, you know, we couldn't have foreseen this before. So you're definitely kind of up against things like that. I think if I, you know, if I were a founder approaching anything, I think you have to ask yourself, you know, if you're trying to apply AI to it or generative AI specifically, I think you have to ask yourself, like, how can we create true value that this tool wouldn't, like, that the incumbent wouldn't be able to build themselves? I think
Bonanza Growth Podcast, innovation, strategy, and UX for SaaS. Bonanza Studios is a growth consultancy for SaaS and fintech startups. Every SaaS business needs to fight in three different battles. First, product market fit, discovering a growing marketing and designing a compelling and undeniable solution to meet that demand. Second, product-led growth, turning your product into a growth vehicle by leveraging outcome-driven UX design. And third, creative marketing and organic brand building. If you're looking for a reliable partner to drive growth, check out our website at bonanza-studios.com.
Hello, everyone. So I've got one interesting guy, very, 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 very looking forward to talk to him. Jack is here, CEO, founder of Spoke AI. And very interesting to get his brain on generative AI, RAG models, and what he has been doing for past couple of years. Jack, how are you doing?
Hey, good. Thanks for having me. One small correction, by the way, I'm the CPO here, not the CEO. Exactly. Yeah, that's Max's job, my co-founder, so I won't take his title as well.
So what's the founding team look like?
We're three co-founders here. So I lead product, and then through that, obviously design as well, and engineering. Max does go-to-market, legal, operations. And then Carl, our third co-founder, is leading everything around data, but also lots of automation topics. So making sure that, you know, you can actually scale things in a more sustainable, scalable way than otherwise would be the case, or especially around kind of marketing channels, for example.
I would love to ask this question. How did you come up with the idea of a Spoke? But I feel like if you want to provide a good answer for it, we need to go back a bit. And all the work you have been doing for N26, all the different projects. So maybe walk us through your journey from you define the timeline till now.
Sure. Yeah, so I started at N26 back in 2016. We had just got the banking license. So they were moving away from Wirecard at the time, which was obviously, I think, with everything that happened with Wirecard, an especially good decision. So N26 had got his banking license, and I started there on the product side. I was super fortunate to work on lots of different product things. I mean, any fast-moving organization, you know, there are always lots of interesting opportunities, and I worked on stuff related to savings accounts, to an insurance wallet, to parts of the premium product. But I did a lot of stuff around KYC, and that was, for anyone who doesn't know that, that stands for Know Your Customer, and it's basically the process of how you approve people to join the product, right? So how, you know, someone shows typically their passport, proves who they are, and then you let them in. And we were onboarding 10,000 new users every day then, so it was a pretty hectic time, and we had to come up with interesting, novel ways of doing that, doing it in a sort of scalable way, but also that would be secure and compliant. So I worked a lot on that topic with Max, who's my co-founder here at Spoke. And we really built that out. That was super interesting, and we were able to then start scaling to sort of 10,000 users every day and onboarding those people really well. And then I took over the AI topics there at N26. I was leading those from the product side. And that was namely building out kind of the chatbot experience there. So we, of course, you know, as you scale 10,000 users every day, you have a lot of questions. Where's my card? How do I make a transfer? Some money's not showing. Where is it? Et cetera, et cetera. Right. So, you know, these were all being answered by humans at that point. And a big focus was how you scale those in order to take burden off humans, but make sure humans are there for the really critical pieces. So that was a big, big focus. And I think in the end, I was there, so worked on it for about 12 months. And we had launched that and scaled that to account for about 37-38% of N26's customer service volume end to end, which was a great result. But through that full time at N26, I mean, when I joined, it was about 80 people. And when I left, it was, I think, 1,500. So through 3 years, it went, you know, really kind of hyper growth. And obviously, the experience was one of chaos that comes with hyper growth companies, but also, you know, lots of information, lots of things to stay on top of. Slack was a nightmare. Things were blowing up there. You know, you had Jira, you had Asana we were using. There was stuff in GitHub, you know, Confluence. It was all over the place, basically. And me as a PM, and I saw this with the other PMs as well, we just struggled with staying on top of everything. You know, was some particular piece of information important? We had stuff in email as well, of course, especially with C-level, for example. You know, so it was very difficult to kind of cut through and to triage and understand, you know, is this important? How should I prioritize it? What is it about? And those were just things kind of related directly to you. There were also just the broader things. You know, when there were a bunch of PMs, you, of course, need to basically stay on top of what's happening in those other teams. So how do you do that, you know, when there are a million Slack channels and they're all blowing up constantly and there are, you know, tons of projects that you're involved in? So it really, like, the nucleus for the idea of Spoke really came out of this feeling of drowning in information and not being able to really cut through all of that noise and understand what's most important, what do I need to do about it, and helping me to actually take action on that.
So when you were part of the KYC team, right? And if you want to map it out, how many different teams you were like interacting with to bring that KYC concept to realization?
Probably with the KYC team, we were probably interacting with at least two or three other product teams. And then outside of that, we would have been interacting obviously heavily with operations, with legal, with marketing, because for them it was relevant, you know, when we would be able to launch a new market and which KYC method we would use. You're, of course, interacting with customer service because they need to be briefed on all of those processes. So it would have been probably in total at least, let's say, kind of eight different stakeholder groups, then including the founders as well.
Yeah, that's the mess. That's the mess you're talking about. Like working with 6-7 other teams at the same time, as well as the executives, while you're part of a bigger organization, 1,500 at the end.
Yeah, exactly. That can be a big challenge for sure.
And that was the nucleus, the hunch for Spoke. Okay, how can we streamline this? Because at the end of the day, you cannot remove Slack or Microsoft Teams or Discord from the equation because you want that daily encounter. That's very needed. You cannot rely on WhatsApp, or especially at that time as well, it was a trend towards more remote and more like, you know, hybrid mode of collaboration. So it didn't even add more complexity to the way that teams are communicating. Even if, let's say, everyone was in the same office, like at least the core teams, you were not able to manage all this conversation while you have to work within your own team.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, actually, then it was an incredibly, like, it was pre-COVID, right? So this was 2016 to 2019. So most of the people were in the office, but then we started expanding. So we opened an office in New York, we opened an office in Barcelona. And, you know, you'd be trying to interact with these people in the same ways that you had interacted with others before, which was often like going and grabbing a meeting room, hashing something out on a whiteboard, and approaching it like that. So it was a different way of working. And I think we all as PMs struggled towards that. So it was like Slack was noisy. There were lots of meetings. Stuff was a mixture of sync and async, but not in a very productive way. There wasn't a very good kind of written culture, I think. So it made it kind of even more noisy, even less structured, and harder to stay on top of all of those things.
Do you think Slack is an environment, is an ecosystem well suited to the work of hybrid or remote teams? Or because the way I'm thinking about Slack came about when everyone was in the office, right? And that may have worked for that settings, but I'm very skeptical towards the notion that Slack is a great tool to manage the work amongst hybrid and remote teams.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think that Slack is, it's kind of a necessary evil, I think, today in terms of like, you know, you sort of can't work with it and you can't work without it insofar as that, you know, it's where everyone is. People, the statistics speak for themselves. You know, people are spending nine hours a day usually in Slack. Yeah, that's, of course, flicking out to other tools and stuff. But it's often, you know, if you walk past someone's desk, yeah, you see they've got like their monitor open, maybe with some documents or what, yes. Jira or whatever, Figma. And then they've got their computer and it has Slack open. Right. So it's telling you that it's ubiquitous. It's constantly present in people's days. I think it's a necessary evil because people need it to work, that everyone is, that's where everyone's hanging out. But there's a lot of bad ways of working that come from Slack. You know, people often expect instant responses, or you're always on, you know, you're getting notifications on your phone. People maybe like don't write in such a structured way because you can know you can kind of machine gun over 10 messages. Yes. And are like, you know, and we'll figure it out along the way, right? So I think many ways that there are many things that Slack does that actually cause us more stress, but I'm yet to see a better alternative. I think that, you know, what we've been trying to do with Spoke is make sense of across all your notifications, help you to really understand when something is important, when it isn't important, give you the summary, you know, straight away, label it for you. Do you need to take action on it? Triage it, you know, is it some coming from a priority personal channel? So helping you with all of these things, which I think Slack is missing today. So really helping you with those factors that Slack misses. But I think that Slack itself is, you know, also adding some functionality around these things, but it's still not, I think, where it needs to get to today.
I mean, both Discord and Slack attempted to address this problem by offering summary of, okay, what's going on in this channel, what has gone down today amongst all the channels, so you can channel your attention. But we are on Discord and I have interacted with that feature. It's a button on top side of the Discord that you can click and it just opens and you see a summary, which I don't find it intuitive. I don't find it that, you know, because I'm here on Discord, like this is my settings, and there's a button on top. I click on it, it opens up, and I see things. So, and I've also seen examples. There is an app, I forgot the name, that it sits on top of Slack and try to basically summarize the conversations that are happening amongst channels in much more organized way. There are attempts, but I believe there will be a Slack disruptor at some point that's going to see all the nuances, all the pain points that especially PMs or executives, product leaders, team leaders that they are facing, and try to streamline it. Basically, a Slack for the new work that is happening mostly in hybrid settings.
Yeah. I mean, something you pointed out there, I think is really interesting, that button experience where you need to click something to generate a summary, for example. I mean, we have a big thesis, which is around kind of proactive versus reactive. Yeah. Mm. And reactive is exactly this experience that exists often today, is clicking something, pressing a button, whatever, to get some kind of response. And the experience that that creates is always like you breaking flow to take an action. It might take a little bit of time for that summary to generate, for example, or whatever it is that the AI is doing. And ultimately, that's you breaking flow. You know, that could also be you having to switch out of somewhere to go and search for something. And we believe that the future of AI is much more around proactive action. You know, you should have that summary before you even know you need it. You should have information pushed to you without having to search. You should have things suggested in a way that is helpful. It shouldn't be noisy. You don't want, you know, all of this generated content to be clouding your view, but it should be there automatically if you need it, rather than you having to break flow in order to go and actually take action. And I think this is one of the problems with some of the AI experiences that we've seen to date, is that they're very reactive in how they're designed.
100%. I think if any founder is trying to build an AI native or AI first application, they need to see that the core differentiation that an AI native app could bring to the experience, like, could, is that proactive nature, is that I'm giving you the summary before even you think you need that summary. I'm giving you the insight before you even, it's not even on your radar. I'm giving it to you because it's important for you to look at it right now, because in other channels, something is blowing up and you are in part of that project. You are responsible for it. You need to see it.
Totally. Yeah, I think that's exactly it. Is it should do the thinking for you. You know, it understands that something nearby is important and it is connecting all of these dots between it. Obviously, very difficult to do, but that is definitely where we see the technology going. I think, that is a kind of a crucial part of how the experience will evolve. Of course, there are questions of cost, right? So, you know, we saw it, if you generate a summary for every thread, every channel all the time, if you're constantly doing that, that's going to cost you a lot of money because you're calling all of these APIs and getting responses and you may not need them. So I think we're still at this point where it's a balancing act. It's like true proactivity means generating everything and regenerating it, connecting dots, searching in the background constantly. Okay, that's not cost efficient, but then the reactive solution is not valuable. So what is the middle ground between these two? And that's certainly something that we've been trying to explore.
And that's the $1 million question. That's a question that all the investors, especially investors that are active in the productivity space, trying to figure out. What's that golden formula? Like, you know, Spoke, piggybacking on major productivity application, like Linear, like Slack, Jira, what have you, right? So basically you are ecosystem dependent. And I've looked at Spoke enough to sort of understand a bit the architecture and the history behind it. And we had a previous conversation about it as well. So you started the first working version of the Spoke was a Slack bot. So basically your hypothesis probably was along the line of Slack has 18, 19 million daily active users. Why do we want to build a separate app? Why don't we go into the environment where everyone is active? So how did that hypothesis work out for you in terms of engagement that you've been seeing? Is this because I've seen a lot of other apps also doing it. So I'm curious to know whether that's a viable approach to go to a busy environment where everyone is and everyone is not getting the productivity they're seeking and trying to provide value there.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think that obviously, as we've talked about, people are hanging out in Slack, right? It is the place where they are most of the time, right? So I think it does make sense to go to where people are. It's very difficult to, you know, build a whole new product that sits alone, requires everyone to go to. Obviously, Slack is only valuable if there are people in there. Yeah. And if you're trying to replace Slack, you need to have people in your tool to do anything on top of that. So I think that there are like there are advantages to going and being where the people are and where those eyeballs are. And I think that that is super important. However, it's also challenging building in the Slack environment. Like the sort of infrastructure that they provide for building Slack apps is limited. It's limited in terms of the UI that you can use. It's limited in terms of the UX. I think it's something that they built a few years ago, and then they've kind of left it there, and they haven't really allowed that to evolve, which is, I think, a shame because, you know, as we've said, like people are there, people need apps in there to make the use of Slack data, to trigger other workflows. But that ecosystem isn't developing as much as it could because of the limitations around what they've provided in terms of infrastructure. So it's kind of like this. Yeah, it's a shame because I think it is providing value, but it's not providing as much value as it could. But it definitely makes a lot of sense as a place to start and a way of validating a product. Our first application, as you mentioned, was a Slack app. And, you know, it allowed users to summarize a thread, summarize a channel on demand, and then later evolved into something that would allow them to set up a recurring summary of those places, right? So then again, moving more towards this sort of proactive, albeit scheduled approach. And that was, I think, super useful. And we have lots of users that for whom that is part of their core workflow every day is seeing the summary from Spoke. But again, there was friction because of the nature of building a Slack app and, you know, how that experience would look. It was similar to how you mentioned with Discord, pressing a button, right? And that's just such a reactive, flow-breaking process and experience to go through.
So earlier stage startup typically identify a core pain point that, and they're trying to design a painkiller around it. So I've faced this, a lot of other founders, product leaders, team leaders face this, like really managing all this chaos in Discord channels, Microsoft Team channels, Slack channels. I'm adding another layer of complexity. We are a design agency. Our conversations are happening on Discord. Our client conversations are happening on Slack, something on Microsoft Teams. When there is like a cross-platform communication is happening, it's even more chaos, right? So you started with this Slack bot, and then you started seeing that it's providing value, but potentially it's not enough of value that you can charge folks for it, right? And at the end of the day, as a B2B SaaS app, you need to generate cash flow to be able to, you know, move forward with your product roadmap. So what was the journey from releasing the MVP, so to speak, first solid workable MVP on a Slack bot, to building a standalone platform that is now known as Spoke AI?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that probably we could charge for our Slack app, but it was a strategic decision not to. I think that that's an important caveat to that discussion. But I mean, the process basically looked like, you know, let's get the Slack app out in order to learn more about the summarization capability, right? So that, you know, we launched that early last year. And then we started working on what was then a web app. So in the browser, and we knew that what we wanted to do was basically take that experience that was at that stage reactive and turn it into something proactive. So as your messages would be coming in, Spoke would be clustering them, it would be labeling them, you know, this is a question or this requires action. And of course, it would be summarizing them. And then, you know, we were building that out and adding additional functionality to create value, like generating out the action points from a conversation and assigning those to you or to whoever was involved, so it was clearer what was happening there. We were adding, for example, prioritization functionality, so you could ensure that the stuff coming from the most important people or channels was coming through first. We were allowing you to then take actions from those places, right? You know, actually create a ticket out of it or schedule a meeting out of it, with then that information populating into those places. So that was kind of the journey we went through. But what we definitely saw is that, you know, when you're dealing with an interface and an experience like Slack, people complain about it all the time, right? But they're also incredibly addicted to it. And you know, there's a reason for that, is that the experience is good. It's a snappy app. It's fast. You usually have keyboard shortcuts. You have workflows in there that you know, that you understand. People are pretty good at using Slack, essentially, because they're using it so much. So we definitely saw that friction that comes from, you know, putting an experience on top of Slack, and some of the challenges that that caused. Even though, you know, we were creating value with that summarization, that labeling, sometimes we found that it was just, you know, you're adding functionality, but you're creating friction. So you're removing some friction, but you're creating friction in different ways. And I think that's a real challenge for AI in general, is like how you add value without creating that friction. Because of course, if you know, if there's more generative capability, if you're summarizing stuff, information has to go somewhere in this UI. Like, so you have to, you know, if the answer is just adding more stuff into a UI that is already pretty crowded, usually that's tough, you know. And I mean, I'm sure you know this as a designer, like you want to strip all of that stuff out of the UI. You want it to be as minimal as possible whilst being as intuitive as possible. So if you're adding more things in, often you're creating friction. I think that was definitely a challenge that we have faced, and something that was then important for us to kind of evolve the experience. So then going into moving the experience into a desktop app, allowing it to be also devolved to the kind of Mac OS level. So you had something in the menu bar that would pop up with the latest conversations you had, and trying to basically make this experience frictionless and deeply integrated. I think we're not there yet today, but it's definitely the direction that we want to take it in. And I think the direction where AI will go is to become more devolved to the operating system level.
So for founders that are, and there is a lot of them for one, Jack, that they're looking into the generative AI space, and because they're basically, it's such a worldwide west right now when it comes to generative AI application, that you can easily like pick any category, pick any vertical, and say how you can make it better with generative AI, right? So there is a lot of gravity around founding new startups, developing new apps that challenge the status quo and try to improve it. You mentioned that you released the Slackbot last year. And I think when did you found Spoke?
We founded it about a year and a half before that. We went through a couple of pivots that I think is natural in an early stage startup. And part of that was understanding what the right use case and application for summarization was early on. We actually started out building something that was summarizing stand-ups, essentially. And the idea was to aggregate all of that information and cascade it upwards. So, you know, you could summarize across multiple stand-ups in like a group of teams, let's say, and then connect the dots to other things. I think I believe that the outcome of that would be very valuable, but like the input data wasn't structured in the right way to create a valuable outcome. So we moved kind of and iterated on that. And then we really started working on this more recent approach just at the very beginning of last year. So start of 2023.
Got it. That's fascinating too, that you attempted to address another big pain point for teams, which is stand-ups initially. And I think that's a big pain point as well. I have it, a lot of other product leaders have it, that these stand-ups don't make sense. How can we make it more, how can we have more productive stand-ups? Applying the summary, being proactive approach to daily stand-ups also makes sense as well. And it will work, because if I have that summary before having that daily stand-ups, I can go to that call and hold that call more productively, asking better questions, have better conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So for founders that they're trying to look into exploring with generative AI and probably looking at different verticals depending on their own expertise and past experiences, having gone through this journey, now having workable products, and active users, what were the challenges you were facing that it became tougher than you initially expected or slow you down in the process of launching the latest stable version of Spoke AI for folks that are trying to get their head around whether they need to come in and do something with Gen AI?
That's a tough question to answer. I mean, I think I alluded to some of the challenges we faced around, you know, people's addiction to Slack and the friction that we were actually adding whilst creating value. And I think that was a big challenge that we definitely hadn't kind of fully grasped before we started the process. And that can be, you know, also just little things like within the Spoke desktop app, you know, you have Slack working in there and within there, like huddles weren't working properly, for example. So just like little pieces of friction like this, where you're like, holy shit, like how did we, you know, we couldn't have foreseen this before. So you're definitely kind of up against things like that. I think if I were a founder approaching anything, I think you have to ask yourself, you know, if you're trying to apply AI to it or generative AI specifically, I think you have to ask yourself, like, how can we create true value that this tool wouldn't, like, that the incumbent wouldn't be able to build themselves? I think that, you know, the availability and commoditization of the technology, it means that a lot of people can do some, you know, some valuable stuff, some less valuable stuff, but a lot of people are able to add summarization, for example. You know, a lot of people are able to add a generative capability to create something out of something else, you know, text input, please expand on this, turn it into whatever. So I think that there are like lots of opportunities to do that, but you have to ask yourself, how defensible is this? How much are we really, you know, is this going to become a system of record? Is it going to become a system of intelligence even? And is this something that the incumbent could replace themselves? Is it something that Google would do, that Microsoft would do, that Slack would do, for example? So you really have to ask yourself these things. And I think the other question you have to ask yourself is this something that will become obsolete because OpenAI will offer it? Yeah. You know, I think that we've seen like in the last 1.5 years, how many companies OpenAI has wiped out, you know, with things like voice to text, with obviously the summarization capability, you know, with the chat experience, but also now with, you know, with video and stuff like this. So with image generation. So, you know, they are obviously working at a speed and an intensity with a data set that is, you know, truly novel, and they're able to create a lot of value like this. So there's really a question, which is like, how defensible is what you're going to be building in 9 months' time or 6 months' time? And of course, you can have a hypothesis on that. You can't truly know. But I think if you can go in a really narrow vertical use case, then there's an opportunity to create something defensible. But it really can't just be a wrapper around OpenAI, around GPT-4 or GPT, whatever it will be at that stage. It has to be doing something that's truly valuable and very specific to a use case rather than something more generic, I believe.
I totally agree. The narrow side of things. So two things I could react to what you said. I listened recently to a podcast between Lex Fridman and the CEO of ChatGPT.
Sam Altman.
Sam Altman, yes. And they are going to introduce memory. So it's going to memorize everything that you have inputted to ChatGPT. That right there is going to create a path to wipe out a lot of application that just really leverage memory as part of their core offering. It's one single functionality that if added to ChatGPT through the use of plugins and third-party apps, it could really disrupt certain application that right now leverage the lack of that ability of ChatGPT.
100%. I think, and it happens overnight, right? You don't know it's coming, and then one day you wake up and OpenAI has destroyed your company in the next 5 years of of what's happening there. So it's, I think it's really interesting. There are also, you know, there are interesting companies also in the video recording space and transcribing meetings. There are tons of them right now. They're not all going to be out there like by the end of this year, even, you know, whether OpenAI goes in that direction or whether it'll be someone else. There's a company that our investors also invested in, Supernormal, that I think is doing really exciting stuff in the space. So, you know, there's definitely going to be a consolidation of lots of players. And it's been exciting over the last year and a half to see how many AI companies have come on the scene, but there's definitely not space for all of them. So there's going to be consolidation. There's going to be a lot of people going out of business. And there will be a lot of, I think, exciting ideas that do get lost in that process as well.
You mentioned something about narrow focus and being vertical friendly. What do you mean by that? I would love for you to expand on this.
So I think that, you know, if you're doing something that's a bit more generic, let's say you're just summarizing text, yeah, then this is something that, you know, OpenAI can disrupt very easily. But let's say that you go in a direction where you are becoming the, you know, the vertical SaaS for a very specific type of law, for example, and lawyers as your customers, not even just lawyers in general, but let's say you're going after, you know, I don't know so much about the legal space, but like you're going after a particular type of commercial or real estate law and very specific, then you're likely to be able to develop a product which is much more fine-tuned and much more geared towards the challenges and the problems that people in that individual space face. Whereas OpenAI or whoever we're talking about, you know, they might provide a more generic solution to summarizing something or to, you know, creating an agent that will perform a particular action. So you will likely have something that's much more defensible by going much more niche, which doesn't mean it needs to be a small business, but it's much more defensible if you can really build something out for that specific target audience. And OpenAI have also said that they don't want to go after super specific niches. You know, for them, they're building for the masses, and that makes sense for their business strategy, their distribution approach. But I think if you want to build something, then going for that niche makes much more sense in terms of having a company that's viable and profitable over time.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I could come up with like a couple of examples right off the bat. For example, a fine-tuned model for exercises, a fine-tuned model to help pregnant women throughout their labor and after labor. So the more you can fine-tune your model, you can build it off the top of a pre-trained model, but the more you can fine-tune it with prompt engineering, with what have you, and have a model that is really specific to you, that could help guarantee that you have a moat. I mean, in this space, having a moat may only last few years, but few years in the business and generating cash flow could ensure that another 2-3 years of, you know, being in the space and trying to even more providing a specific value.
Yeah, I think it's also not just about using a model for one process or pre-training a model for one thing. I think it's about orchestrating connections between lots of things. Like if we look at our product and the experience there, there are so many pieces of AI that we're using, right? We cluster messages, we label them, we summarize them, we generate action points, we surface related information using the RAG infrastructure. So these are like already are five things. We understand also if something, the state of something, has it been answered or not. So like orchestrating and combining all of this stuff into an experience is something that will create a moat and create something unique inside of your product, not rather than it just being some kind of wrapper for OpenAI or GPT. And you see with these custom GPTs, right? These are just very specific kind of pre-trainings. I was using one the other day, which is like a language teacher, right? So you can chat back and forth with this fake language teacher. This is amazing. Wow. But, you know, you can imagine that someone might have built a whole separate product before that, you know, that was an AI language teacher. And OpenAI has wiped that out overnight by allowing the configuration creation of these custom GPTs. So I think that really, if you're going to build an external product, it has to combine things in a way which creates some kind of system of record or system of intelligence externally to those models, right? It has to do something with that information that wouldn't be easily replicable otherwise.
So basically incorporating a series of actions that needed to take place to provide an output. So in your point, we summarize it, we label it, we pulling information from different applications. So the more you are able to compute complex multi-step actions to provide an output, that could increase, well, add to your moat.
Exactly. I think that that's where the differentiation exists. Or for example, if you're creating a new category of data, like I think if we look at what we're doing is we're understanding, obviously we're not creating the category of text data, you know, that exists in Slack and email, etc. What we are creating though is the understanding semantically between similarity across those things. So we understand, you know, does this Jira ticket relate to this Slack conversation or this other Slack conversation or this Notion page? So this is one way of thinking about it. And the other or another example would be all of the meeting summarization, right? So we've now gone from a place where we had, you know, either in-person meetings or we have, you know, video calls that weren't recorded or weren't transcribed. And now that transcription process is creating this new category of data that people can start to do something with. And I think that this is really interesting as a new data source in order to understand relationships, to understand connections, and to understand and leverage that in a way that I think right now is not really even it sounds very conceptual, but I think that there are huge opportunities there and opportunities for differentiation that don't really exist or we haven't seen so far today.
Two follow-up questions here. One is about the battle of integrations, especially for Spoke AI, in order to provide a 360-degree bird's eye view of all the activities and provide actionable, valuable insight. You need to be able to constantly integrate in different apps because hardly you find two teams that use the same apps, right? So how do you go about this? And there is another follow-up question I have regarding the cost of running a Gen AI startups.
So, I mean, our approach when it came to integrations is we first built out direct API integrations with different tools. We had Slack already. That was obviously the cornerstone, but then we built out Jira, Confluence, Figma. There was another one. We started with Notion. Yeah, Linear we built, thank you. Exactly. So, and what we found is that they weren't really serving up information to us in the way that we wanted it. Oh, we looked at other tools. So, and the reason for that is that their APIs just aren't designed for that kind of usage. So it was like, you know, you have in the Jira API, right? I can create a ticket programmatically, right? I can post to an endpoint and create a ticket, or I can query something, but they're not really created for getting notifications and understanding that structure in real time. So this was a challenge that we faced. And we also played around with tools like merge.dev. And there's another really interesting tool, which is integration.app, which we haven't used actually, but I think I've been quite impressed with kind of the direction that they're going in, which is to kind of act as this aggregation layer between your tool and all of these APIs. So they do the dirty work, they connect to those, and you're integrating with one tool. What we did actually was to take a completely different approach, and that was to use the pre-existing Slack infrastructure. So I'm sure you've got Slack apps from your tools running through there, Jira, for example, or Notion or Linear. They connect to Slack already and they're sending a lot of that information in there. So what we did was take that approach. So we said like, all right, let's process the Slack data. You've got, you know, you've got your channels, you've got your DMs, you've got your group messages. This is on one side. And then you've got your app data.
Yeah.
So how can we filter that out? How can we understand that? And how can we then surface that to you in a valuable way? So using a pre-existing infrastructure allowed us to actually plug in more apps more quickly without building those direct API integrations. It meant that you didn't need to, as a user, handle all of the authentication process. You don't need to set up an API key. Maybe you don't need to get permission, etc. So that was actually a kind of a lightweight way of us doing that. Obviously, it has limitations because you're not able to query against the Jira API or something, but you can start to index that data and understand how it relates to other stuff that's coming in, because you can understand timing, for example, of when communication is coming in, so how it might be related to other stuff happening in Slack. So you can still build this data model and this network graph on the basis of that, but albeit with some limitations. And that's actually an interesting topic that we're thinking about, how we go further there to combine the best of both approaches. Do you allow users also to connect Jira via the API so you can get additional data there? And that's something that we're kind of looking at the moment and thinking about the right next steps there.
Google Ad has a really interesting approach. It allows you to set up your campaign really fast, so you can get your money, so to speak. But as you're paying towards Google and getting impression and clicks, offer your recommendation that, hey, if you do certain action, if you invest in Google Ad by verifying your business, by improving your callouts, by adding the conversion tracker, you get 12% more conversions. So maybe that might be interesting for you as well, not to disrupt the flow of like bringing new user in and engage them, but just as they are using Spoke further, you can incentivize them to invest more in Spoke by integrating through your own channel and get more out of it.
Yeah, I love that. I think that makes a lot of sense. That feeling that you can get started with something and then add those things on afterwards. And otherwise that UX flow is like, half an hour setup in the beginning for what value, right? You need to see that value and it needs to accrue for you to then invest more time into that. So I definitely agree with that approach. That resonates with me a lot.
Jack, cost. It's something that is, a lot of people are talking about it. And so my question here is, as a conversation starter, can Gen AI startups offer a flat fee per seat? Is that feasible?
It depends what the flat fee is, and it depends what your model is of generation. I think that, for us, we do a lot of generating of stuff. As I've mentioned, there are many parts to the experience: clustering, labeling, summarizing, generating action points, etc. That's definitely a discussion that we've had. And, when we introduce pricing in the next couple of months, something that we're thinking about a lot. I think that a good pricing model is one that does scale with value for the user. So as users get more value, they pay more. I think that's fairly straightforward. But on the same side, you also have to give predictability to a tool, right? So especially, if let's say you onboard your team, it's different if you onboard your team knowing you're going to pay $10 a month for each person than if it might go up to $200 a month for each person. You're going to feel very differently about those situations. So giving that predictability is really important. I think that my stance on general pricing and costs is that the costs are going down very quickly of a lot of these models. Yeah. So, we have discussions internally where it's like, should we use GPT-4 for this, or should we use GPT-3.5 Turbo or whatever, or should we use, Model X or Model Y? My approach is always like, yes, we have to be pragmatic. Yes, we have to think about the costs, but we have to validate the user experience right now. When it's pre-product market fit, your goal is really, let's validate user experience and make sure that this is the right approach and that we're creating that value, because if we're optimizing on cost for something that doesn't create value, it doesn't matter anyway, and if we say that we can create value in this way, even if it costs X today, it might be, it might be 10% of that rather in 3 months time to produce that, right? So because these models are moving so fast, so I think really yes, find a pricing approach that makes sense. But remember that in your business case, in your pricing model, those costs are going to change. They're going to go down. They should go down. Obviously, you need to optimize for scale, but don't try and do everything too early. Validate the business case, validate the user need, validate the functionality and the experience that your product can offer before you optimize too much for the financials there.
That's a fascinating answer. I didn't think about it like this, because right now the Moore law applying to the cost of Gen AI responses, and to your point, in 3 months down the road, maybe the cost of this generating an output to any input could go 1/10. And why are you worrying about a problem that is a problem right now, but may not be a problem 3 months down the road?
Totally. I mean, just look at it in terms of tokens, for example, right?
Like, right.
If we think about it a year ago, the token limits in most of these models and those endpoints were pretty small, right? So you would have to, let's say you have to call it 10 times for what you would do today, yeah, for the token limit there. That call today, then maybe the single call is more expensive, maybe it's not, but you're calling it, your efficiency of process is much improved. So this is just an example, a small example, how that cost of compute goes down over time. And something that was a year ago expensive, if you had spent so much time optimizing for that now, for that then, you would have maybe built infrastructure to get around that. You would have maybe changed the product. Was it that important? Like, could you have taken a different approach and said, hey, we'll worry about optimizing that cost a little bit later? I personally think that's the right way to go.
I really appreciate it. And this has been such a really great conversation. I learned tons here, and I would love to be cautious about your time as well. Any last words regarding Spoke, regarding what you're doing next?
I think no last words about Spoke. I think it's been super interesting joining you today. I think I've done it probably too much talking, but thanks for having me. Really great to chat, and really appreciate your outlook on everything as well.
My pleasure. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you for listening to this episode. For more information, go to bonanza-studios.com.